the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Now, I suspect that Nicola Sturgeon may be one of the most popular politicians in Ireland. And the reason why I say that the former Scottish First Minister and leader of the Scottish Nationalist Party is so popular is that it's a sellout in the National Concert Hall later this evening, where I'll be interviewing her about her new book, Frankly. And I know that the reason it's a sellout is not because people want to come and listen to me.
Oh, Nicola, I don't. You should be so quick to say that.
No, I know that, Nicola. Anyway, very good to meet you. This is our first time meeting, and we will have a much lengthier conversation later on this evening. But I very much enjoyed the book. There's so much that I want to get into now and again later on. But I want to start with a paragraph very, very near the end of the book, which really just jumped out at me. You desperately want Scotland to be independent, and you're confident that it's going to happen. And in about 20 years, perhaps sooner, the UK in its current form will no longer exist. And you have a line, you say, an independent Scotland, a more autonomous Wales and a reunified Ireland will join England, enjoying the benefits of the home rule will gain as a result in a new British Isles Confederation of Nations. Tell us more about this. Ireland as part of a British Isles Confederation of Nations?
No, I guess I'm thinking about the British Irish Council and how that could be more influential if Scotland was independent. You know, Ireland may or may not reunify, and despite my personal opinion, that's not a matter for me. Wales is a bit more autonomous. I went to British Irish Council summits throughout my time as First Minister, and I always got a little bit frustrated at how underappreciated that body is. And I think in that future world that I'm describing there, it wouldn't be some kind of union or anything like that, but it would be a forum, I think, a useful forum for collaboration and working together as nations across the British Isles. So that's a tentative prediction. I mean, time will tell whether I'm right or wrong.
But how confident are you really about getting Scottish independence? You came so close back in 2014, but you didn't get another opportunity to get a referendum in. And by the looks of it, the British establishment are taking it. You had your shot. Mm. You didn't win. We're not going to give you another chance to win.
I mean, that's their position at the moment. And although this might be a bit counterintuitive, or it might make me sound as if I'm trying to put a silver lining on a cloud, in a sense, we should, those of us who support Scottish independence, take some comfort from the position of the British establishment. Because if they didn't believe that Scotland would vote for independence at the next time of asking, they wouldn't be so bothered about trying to block the opportunity. So we're in a process, standoff, deadlock. If that wasn't the case, I think Scotland may already have voted for independence. I think that will be overcome when the appetite and the clamour for independence in Scotland becomes irresistible. And I think that will happen in time. Opinion polls overall, you know, show support for independence at around 50%, a bit higher sometimes, but lower other times. But if you look at the demographic breakdown of these polls, you know, support amongst the younger age groups is 60, 65, 70%. So I think the momentum is as close as anything can be to being unstoppable, inevitable. But, you know, those on my side of the argument have still got work to do to convince people that it's not enough just to say, well, yeah, we'd like Scotland to be independent, that it's really important to make that known to a Westminster British establishment so that they can't stand in its way.
Well, give me the sales pitch. Why would Scotland be better off independent?
Well, I guess I would turn that back on people in Ireland. Can you imagine not being independent? Through the tough times and the good times, being independent gives you an ability to chart your own course and be more in control of your own destiny. No, I don't think any country in the modern world is completely independent. You know, there's an interdependency. But having independence, I think for countries like Ireland, I guess the reverse is unthinkable. Independence is the normal state of affairs. And I guess, you know, one of the issues that best illustrates the impact of not being independent for Scotland from recent years is Brexit. You know, Scotland voted against Brexit by a very significant majority. And yet here we are outside of the EU with all of the quite negative consequences that has had. So independence, it's not some kind of panacea. It doesn't magic away all your problems or guarantee success as a country, but it puts the levers that are most important into your own hands.
You mentioned it's the democratic deficit, I think is the phrase that you use in the book, that you and the other parts of the UK that weren't England had all voted in favour of staying in the European Union, but were made to follow England out of the European Union. But yet you also acknowledge in the book that you had argued for Scottish independence, and many of those who argued in favour of Brexit also showed, I suppose, a form of their own nationalism. It was English nationalism that led you along that path.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were some who had voted for Scottish independence, who voted for Brexit, probably as a sort of, you know, rebellion against an establishment worldview. In both cases, I mean, that was a minority of the independence support in Scotland, but nevertheless, it was a group of people that existed. I think there's also a sense of, and this argument frustrates me sometimes, but you know, it's the fact that it is still made is no doubt a sign of the failure of people like me to overcome it sufficiently. But there's a sense of, well, why would you, you know, fight so hard to become independent from the rest of the UK and then, you know, effectively give your sovereignty away to the European Union? I mean, I think that argument is pretty dud, because the European Union is an organisation made up of independent countries, Ireland, of course, being one of them. But these things are complex. And I think what I've learned over the years is identity is complex. It's not straightforward. Arguments for and against statehood are complex. But there's no doubt in my mind, not that, as I said a moment ago, everything in the garden would be automatically rosy for Scotland if we were independent, but at least we'd be in charge of the course we took as a country.
You describe yourself in the book as well as being a Republican. Mm. So then, as a Republican, why is it that you knelt before Queen Elizabeth and kissed her hand? That would be anathema to many Republicans.
I mean, I say in the book, I'm a Republican, and I am by instinct. I don't think for me, over the course of my political career, it's been one of the things I felt most strongly about. I took the view, as somebody campaigning for independence, that, you know, probably Scotland had to become independent and then consider the issue of whether we wanted to be a republic or, as my party's policy currently is, to stay part of the Commonwealth. I also, you know, I was First Minister. I had a responsibility to serve my country. Being in the Privy Council is part of doing that, because obviously that, you know, gives you the ability to get information on a certain basis. So I had to do that in order to do my job. I guess the edge, any sort of discomfort I felt about that was blunted at least by the fact I had huge respect for the late Queen. She was somebody that I spent quite a lot of time with over my years as First Minister, and whatever my views on monarchy might be, I had enormous respect for her. I think she was a remarkable woman.
Those of us who would have seen programmes like The Crown would have seen these regular set pieces where the British Prime Minister would be called in for a weekly audience. Yeah. But do the likes of you and the Welsh leaders actually have your own time on a regular basis with the monarch?
Yeah, it's not weekly. I had an audience with the Queen twice a year. So once in the summer in Edinburgh, in Holyrood Palace, when she would come for a few days, then once usually in the autumn in Balmoral, her, you know, Scottish estate, and that would be an overnight stay, which, you know, had got some amazing memories of that. But these audiences with her were incredibly privileged times. It was literally me and her in a room alone, and you're talking to somebody who has lived and, in her case, reigned through all of the momentous events for, you know, much of the 20th century, and to have that kind of window on 20th century history and some of the people she'd interacted with. The first private audience I had with her, you know, we chatted about, you know, she talked to me about audiences with Winston Churchill and, you know, speaking to and having been visited by JFK and Jackie Kennedy after he became president. You know, I think for anybody, but particularly somebody who's a bit of a political geek like me, I mean, sitting listening to that was just incredible.
But coming from your background, coming from council housing estate, coming from not having much material goods, how did it feel then to be going to places like Balmoral and to be seeing this utter excess, which essentially the Scottish taxpayer is contributing to?
Yeah, look, I mean, well, firstly, if you told me when I was a kid growing up in Ayrshire in the west of Scotland that I was going to sit in a room alone with the Queen, I would have, you know, laughed at you. So those kind of experiences would have been unthinkable. But yeah, I do feel uncomfortable at the vast inequalities of wealth in my country. And I think actually, and yes, the system of monarchy is part of that, but it's not all about that. Those vast wealth inequalities are, I think, one of the biggest drivers of some of the global political trends we're seeing right now. You know, people like Trump and Farage exploiting that, but instead of levelling with people that it's inequality that's causing the cost of living crisis for ordinary people, they're trying to tell people it's immigration or, you know, LGBT people, whatever. So I think tackling that inequality gap's got to be one of the things that progressive politicians have to work out how to do.
And I want to come back to the current state of politics in a moment, but one last one in relation to the royal family. You had an extraordinary paragraph, and I'm going to read it, in which you said, having had the opportunity to observe the royal family up close, I've little doubt that history, however long the sweep of it might be in this respect, will look back on the day of her death as the beginning of its end.
Yeah, I believe that. Again, it's a bit like my prediction about the, you know, the sort of rewiring of the British Isles relationships. Time will tell if I'm right or wrong, but I say however long the sweep of history might be, so I'm not saying this is 10 years, it could be 10, 50, 100 years, but having observed the royal family up close, there was a mystique and an aura around the late Queen. And partly, no doubt, that was because she reigned in a time before, not just before social media, but before, you know, 24-hour news media. So there was a, I don't know, I just that this aura around her. You almost felt it, the hairs on the back of your neck when she walked into her room. None of the others, and I don't mean any disrespect to them, but none of the others have that. And I think when you, because monarchy is such a kind of strange system in some ways, when you take away that sense of mystique and aura that, you know, encourage people to sort of look up to it, then I think over time, the absurdities of monarchy will come more to the fore. And I would predict that we will, well, what I said in the book, I think in times to come, we will look back and think, well, it didn't end the day she died, but the beginning of its end probably set in when she died.
It's very clear from the book that from a very early stage, from your teens, you became obsessed with politics. And I don't think obsessed is too strong a word.
I wouldn't rail against that. I think that's a reasonable description.
So how much do you miss it now? Or did it become, and I think you sort of referred to it there, the way that there is a certain toxicity at present in the way that politics is conducted and how some of the public interacts with politics. Do you miss it? Or do you feel that you just had enough of it?
So I'm still a Member of Parliament in Scotland, so I'm not out of politics. I will be in a few months' time. I miss the, sometimes, not all of the time, I miss the sort of, you know, just being in the thick of things in the way that you are when you're leading a country. And I miss the, you know, constantly being on the go. I miss the people that I used to work with, the people I got to meet. So yeah, of course there are aspects of it that I miss. You know, being First Minister was, you know, the best job I could ever have wanted. And I became increasingly uncomfortable, and I take my share of responsibility for the state of political discourse. But the still relatively recent kind of descent of political debate into a really toxic, unpleasant gutter, I felt I didn't want to be part of in the same way that I had before. I also think, I mean, I'll never stop caring about politics and about the issues that are close to my heart, but there are different ways, I think, to contribute to them. And I think for the next phase of my life, having spent so long in frontline politics, finding different ways to contribute is certainly more suited to where I'm at. Politics, you described it as an obsession for me. And I don't think that is, you know, an exaggeration. But when you're so I guess it's the same in any walk of life. But in my case, in politics, from a very young age, I was so single-minded about pursuing, you know, politics and then a political career that I probably, you know, just pushed to one side some of the other things I should have been doing when I was young, you know, having fun, for example. So I think I'm at a stage in my life where I want to think about life in a bigger, wider sense and not be so constrained by politics.
But was it all worth it?
Yeah, look, I've had the most extraordinary career. I wouldn't change what I chose to do at all. It's been amazing. I mean, if I could turn the clock back and, you know, tell my, I don't know, 16-year-old self the life I was going to lead, I mean, she probably wouldn't have believed it, but she would have been thrilled at the idea. So no, I don't regret it. But I think in life, you've got to know when the time is right to move on. And for me, that time is now. And I'm looking forward to doing other things. You know, I've got, hopefully, a lot of life left to live. And the lucky position I'm in is that I can, you know, look forward to doing different things, like writing a book, for example, something that I always dreamed of doing, even as a child.
I think you could probably turn to crime fiction, though, given what you've said in the book.
I'm great. I mean, reading novels is probably my first love, and it's what I do to relax and switch off. I've got a few friends who are writers. Actually, I was walking around here earlier on and just ran on the street to Paul Lynch, the Booker winner, who I interviewed at the Edinburgh Festival last year. So Dublin's a great place for things like that. So I've got a lot of friends who are writers, which actually makes me realise not everybody can write a novel. But I'd love to have a go at it.
I'm going to have to leave it for now. I'm looking forward to meeting you later in the National Concert Hall, although my understanding is it is fully sold out, as I said at the outset, such is your popularity. The book is tremendous. It really is a really fascinating read. It's called Frankly. Nicola Sturgeon, thank you very much for joining us.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.